than that, right?
That's true. Our conversations could be political, but also comical. We're really just giving our point of view on how we see the world and how it affects us today.
And stay tuned for the Covert Action Bulletin. It's 9 a.m.
Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Our program today is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm your host, Rachel Hu.
And I'm your host, Chris Garaffa. And we're very happy to be here with you on Covert Action Bulletin. On today's show, we'll take a closer look at some of the history between NATO, Ukraine, and Russia, as well as the steps the U.S. and NATO are taking against peace in the region and a realistic resolution of the conflict. Then, we'll dive into some of the week's other news stories. We'll mark the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and what role the U.S. government may have played in his shooting. Also, the missing 457 minutes of Trump's call logs on January 6, 2021, and much more.
So there's so much, Chris, to talk about, but to get started, I think we really want to follow the latest developments on what's going on in the war in Ukraine. But kind of in order to understand this situation, we really have to understand history. So we were very happy and excited to be part of a really excellent event that happened on Friday, April 1st. Covert Action hosted a webinar with a great panel of guest speakers. And the video from that event will actually be available for folks to watch and see and hear what people had to say on Covert Action Magazine. magazine.com very soon. So we're excited to play two clips from this. The first clip of this webinar is from Chris DePlug, who is the author of the book Ukraine on Fire. There's so many cool things we want to get into here, really important piece of history. So let's just toss it to Chris.
I was asked to more or less give a short summary of my book, Ukraine the Crossfire, which of course is impossible in 12 minutes. So I'll focus on some of what I think are the key issues that are generally ignored in Western media and should be heard. And for more extensive references and nuances and depth, I would refer back to my book. But before I talk about Ukraine, I also want to mention that the same week that the Russian invasion of Ukraine started, Yemen, Syria, and Somalia were also bombed by the United States and its allies. The war in Yemen alone has killed an estimated 400,000 people, and the majority of which are children. So this is by no means the only catastrophe engulfing the planet. Even within Ukraine, the current invasion has caused over 1,000 civilian deaths. But the last 8 years of the war in eastern Ukraine has actually led to an estimated 14,000 people dead in eastern Ukraine. So as we know from Chomsky and Herman in their classical work, Manufacturing Consent, Western media tend to consider some victims worthy, which are extensively covered, mostly those that are killed by enemy states, and others unworthy, which are largely ignored, those that are killed by the West and its closest allies. So I think it's important to keep this in mind whenever any conflict starts dominating the airwaves, that we do not go along with the kind of racist and geopolitical double standards on who deserves our solidarity. So with that being said, on to the current conflict. So how should we actually characterize it? Again, the dominant frame that we hear is of a kind of democratic pro-Western Ukraine versus a kind of dictatorial, sometimes called kind of Asiatic Russia, a kind of fight between democracy and authoritarianism, and essentially basically an Orientalist frame. And I also believe this frame is highly problematic. First off, because Ukraine is hardly more democratic than Russia. The conflict started with the violent overthrow of the democratically elected president of Ukraine in 2014, Viktor Yanukovych, after he postponed signing an EU association agreement that was tied to a very harsh IMF austerity package. And although it is true that there were massive protests in Western and Central Ukraine with legitimate grievances against Yanukovych, it is also true that, first of all, they never had majority support, and Yanukovych's support base was always in the east and south of the country. Second, the protests would not have been successful without the willingness to use violence by a capable fascist minority, a minority but a crucial minority, which forced Yanukovych to flee the country basically at gunpoint. And for the best research on this violence, I would definitely like to refer to the excellent work of the Ukrainian political scientist Ivan Kachanovsky. Third, the pro-Western uprising was heavily funded and supported by Western governments, by Ukrainian oligarchs, and by pro-Western opposition parties, who completely co-opted the movement. And fourth, after the overthrow of Yanukovych, Ukraine hardly became a beacon of democracy. Opposition parties were disbanded, opposition media intimidated and banned, presidential candidates assaulted. We saw harsh neoliberal austerity programs implemented, while the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine was reportedly giving, quote, firm orders to Ukrainian government officials, one of the many, many indications of Ukraine essentially becoming a U.S. satellite state, as I document in my book. Election results consistently show a much lower turnout in the eastern and southern Ukraine, sometimes as low as 30% in some regions, which have basically largely opted out of the political process. So clearly, Ukraine is hardly a beacon of democracy. Then on about the actual war, which, as I said, has been going on for 8 years already. So importantly, the war in Donbas was firstly escalated by Ukraine, which immediately basically sent in the military when protesters started seizing government buildings in eastern and southern Ukraine, even as the Euromaidan movement had done the exact same thing only several weeks earlier. The first Easter ceasefire in 2014, before a major war had yet started, was violated by the fascist militia right sector, with approval by the central government, as its leader, Dmitry Yarosh, has openly admitted in an interview. The later Minsk Accords, which were signed by Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France, and actually backed by the full weight of the UN Security Council, was consistently sidestepped by Ukraine, who refused to implement the necessary federalization structure outlined in the agreement. And then finally, the majority of civilian casualties seem to have actually been caused by the Ukrainian military, with notably the exceptions of two major rebel offensives with Russian support in 2014 and 15, which definitely also committed war crimes. But clearly, the war did not start this year, and Ukraine and its Western backers bear major responsibility for not resolving the conflict earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, Rachel, is so important, what Chris said there, and I really encourage people to go catch his full talk. The war did not start this year, and that's the key point that's being made here. And in fact, no war starts the day that the first shot is fired. And it's so important that we understand that, and we have a sense of what the history leading up to this conflict in Ukraine and between, you know, on the face of it, Russia and Ukraine, but really between NATO and Russia, with Ukraine being used as a pawn. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's the reality. You know, Ukraine is being used as a pawn because of its geographical and geopolitical location. And the country, you know, could really be split in two because of the way NATO has been fomenting this conflict particularly since the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it's so important to understand this history for the last 8 years, in particular going back to the Maidan protests, which were politically very complicated in terms of who was involved in them, and then the coup that was led by, you know, really right-wing fascist forces who then held power in the government, who, you know, now do not make up the government, you know, entirely, but still have some sway, particularly in the military and security services. So I think, Rachel, having listened to what Chris Diplogue was saying, you know, I felt like, even though I knew a lot of these things, but having it in the context of a full discussion on the war, I think was really critical to understanding not just what's happening, but why it's happening.
Yeah, without a doubt, Chris, I think it's so important. And I know we keep going back to history, but if we don't understand history of how we got here, it's in some ways impossible to really analyze exactly what's going on. I mean, I think Chris was really, it was really interesting to me too that, Chris DePlog, not you, Chris, mentioned the Minsk agreements. And I think that to me is a really important kind of component of what's going on now in thinking bigger about the fact that, you know, Russia had been very much so willing to abide by what was written in the Minsk agreements, and then seeing them collapse because ultimately this new government, part of the coup government, right, didn't want to actually honor these agreements. I think it's, to me, very important to show that, you know, there was another solution, there was another way out, there was another possibility in terms of what could have been abided by to avoid so much of the death, the destruction of what we're seeing here today. And so I thought that was very valuable in his analysis. And also I thought it was very valuable too, just the mention of Yemen. I mean, we talked a bit about Yemen as well. But I do think this really interesting idea that there are, you know, worthy and unworthy, you know, talking about manufacturing consent, that there are kind of these worthy victims and unworthy victims. I think it is so important in this conflict to pay attention to that, the idea that there's a narrative of worthy victims. I mean, we saw that with all the racism that we've seen towards Ukrainians who are, you know, not, I mean, they're, that are immigrants or that are, you know, black Ukrainians, whatever it might be. But really that this kind of manufacturing consent element that was touched upon, you know, Noam Chomsky's writing, et cetera, et cetera. I just think it's a really important kind of component to bring in all together as we're looking right now at the current state and situation of things. I know I saw an article today actually that I thought was kind of interesting just because I was like, you know, it kind of blows my mind how in the mainstream media, they just kind of put things out there like they're just true and they're just totally not. I read earlier today that top U.S. military officers told lawmakers today that Russia's invasion of Ukraine likely could not have been prevented at all, I guess, except by just the presence of U.S. forces. And basically they were just warning and saying, oh, you know, the conflict in Europe is likely to drag on for years to come, da 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 da. But my point is just to even say that Russia's invasion of Ukraine could not have been prevented couldn't be literally any further from the truth in any way, shape, and form. And I think Chris bringing in the Minsk agreements to me speaks to that point, that really isn't the truth. That in fact, had these agreements been followed and honored in the way that they were meant to be followed and honored, or had there been any level of diplomacy really from NATO on any level, or, you know, really from the Ukrainian government as well, we might have seen a different situation.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the idea that this couldn't have been prevented. I mean, look, Zelensky himself, remember this, before, you know, he became this war hero, right? Zelensky himself was saying, and so, you know, his advisors were saying, y'all, Russia, you need to stop. Like, the U.S., Germany, NATO countries, you need to stop provoking. You are provoking here. What could have happened and what should have happened were negotiations agreed upon by Russia and Ukraine as equal countries who, you know, sitting down with partners that they agreed upon collectively, saying, you know, here's our concerns, Russia's, here's our concerns, Ukraine's, here's how we're going to work this out. Here's what the international community, and I mean the real international community, not what the U.S. says is the international community when it's like, just like the white countries, right? You know, you see those maps, like the international community, it's like the U.S., Canada, Western Europe, and Australia. And it's like,
so international,
right? Yeah, exactly. Because like Africa, South America, China don't exist, right? So like, but like that could have been a thing, right? And like, that's the only way you really stop something like this. Like, I'm not, you know, and then the other thing, and I think we want to get into our next clip with this, Rachel, but like, the other thing is saying, you know, we couldn't have seen it coming. I mean, you absolutely could have, not just from a military or political, like, tactical perspective. I mean, like, it, you know, looking back, I think it was relatively, you know, clear, I guess, what, you know, Russia was doing. But, like, even just looking at the history of imperialism and capitalism and what they require, like, you have to do that. And I want to bring in this clip from Gerald Horn. It's about 4 minutes long. Gerald Horn spoke also on the April 1st webinar. And I really encourage people, again, to listen to the whole thing. Go check out covertactionmagazine.com. Check out our Patreon, where we'll have these clips and the video. But Gerald Horn brings this, like, longer-term background to the development of Europe in the context of imperialism. And just a brief introduction of Dr. Horn, he holds the Morris Professorship of History and African-American Studies, and his research addresses issues of racism in a variety of relations, including labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. So we're going to get right into this clip, and then, Rachel, I want to hear what you have to say about it.
In many ways, this crisis in Eastern Europe reflects a centuries-long problem in Europe. What I mean is, as the Western European nations were getting fat from the plunder of the Americas and the pillage of Africa, they were not necessarily the major force in their own backyard. Speaking of Europe, if you look at your map today, you will readily see that most of European territory is Russian. Most of Europe's natural resources, be it natural gas, petroleum, gold, palladium necessary for building aircraft, is on Russian soil. And indeed, the most populous nation on the European continent is Russia. So what happens, just fast forwarding about 200 years ago, is that Napoleon Bonaparte tries to resolve this contradiction by invading Russia and is defeated. A few decades later, you have the gang up of Britain, France, and the sick man of Europe, speaking of Ottoman Turkey, in the Crimean War of the 1850s, targeting Russia. And then, of course, a few decades later, you have the Londoners sponsoring the Japanese attack on Russia circa 1904, which, of course, helps to accelerate the oncoming Russian Revolution of 1917, with Japan paying back London in spades by seizing its cash cows of Hong Kong and Singapore in 1941-1942, which was a devastating blow to the British Empire, allowing for the rise of the United States, which then a few decades later, as we know, we were marking the 50th anniversary just a few weeks ago, before February 24th, you see the Entente with China and the United States on an anti-Soviet basis. And so, as I said in the Black Agenda report, in some ways, what's been happening is that the North Atlantic countries are akin to Captain Ahab and Moby Dick, driven to crazed self-destruction by chasing after the whale. That is Russia. What's happening also is that Russia is not standing still as these plots are unfolding. You may know, even the New York Times mentioned this a few weeks ago, that in the 1890s, when Italy invaded Ethiopia, Ethiopia was able to repel the invaders because they were armed to the teeth by Russia. And of course, during the Soviet period, we know that the liberation of Southern Africa from the 1970s up to 1994 with Nelson Mandela's election is basically generated and propelled in no small measure by the Soviet arming of the African National Congress of South Africa, the MPLA in Angola, SWAPO of Namibia, etc., and then subsidizing the Cuban troops who administered the most withering blow to the apartheid army on the battlefield. And so in some ways, this present crisis is just another chapter in a centuries-long struggle about how do you resolve this contradiction of somehow bringing on board, in a subordinate manner, of course, Russia into the North Atlantic camp. The second point I'd like to make is the global point. That is to say, in order to really understand the meaning of this crisis, you may want to look at the meeting that took place today, the virtual summit between China and the European Union. And of course, Europe has been rather supine in its relationship to U.S. imperialism, despite President Macron blathering about strategic autonomy. Apparently, Western European imperialism recognizes that the ultimate guarantor of world imperialism is U.S. imperialism. And so that leads to Europe bending the knee to U.S. imperialism, even though ultimately this may backfire a spectacular.
Now, you really got to love everything that Gerald Horn says. Always a pleasure. And if you guys actually made it to this webinar, it was so cool just to have him kind of show up. We thought he might be speaking, but here he was just kind of in the Zoom chat. We're like, oh, Gerald Horn, all right. You want to say something? Because you have so much to share. And I kind of want to pick up a little bit on this last point that he was making. I really appreciate it. You know, thinking about how the U.S. imperialist system is really the ultimate guarantor of world imperialism. I really love that framing and way of thinking about it, because it's absolutely true. I mean, why else would Europe, you know, a continent that has many, many different countries with many, many, many different interests, all be okay with really towing the line of whatever the United States says? I mean, this is part of, and thinking about in particular, the U.S.'s, you know, adversarial relationship to kind of modern day Russia. I feel like this is so much because of the fact that Russia is so geographically close to Europe. And truthfully, Europe and European nations all have a vested interest in some ways of wanting to save money, wanting to be able to be able to have better trade relationships with Russia. It really would be beneficial for them on every single level. And the only reason why they don't have positive relationships with each other is the United States and is the will of the U.S., because the U.S. wants to cut off Europe from Russia to maintain this exact kind of global domination that we are seeing by the United States, the hegemony of the U.S. The other thing I wanted to pick up on, I was curious your thoughts on this too, Chris, was just thinking about this really interesting kind of metaphor that he's putting in there, just about Moby Dick and what it means to like be like catching the white whale. I really feel like the U.S. is the captain here. You know, I really think like in that whole analogy, like the U.S. is the captain, and they, you know, the United States is really leading the entire world down this destructive path. I mean, so many different times the U.S. could have intervened for peace, and they've chosen time and time again not to. But I mean, the U.S. was is it since 1949 or since the 1950s, the United States has invaded well over 60 different nations, either intervening or some sort of political intervention, not just on the ground interventions, but interventions across the globe. So the U.S. is not by any stretch of the imagination a purveyor of peace. So we could not expect that whatsoever. And my last little piece too is the mention of South Africa. And I kind of want to bring this in here. And I know we talked about it briefly before, but I think it's really important right now that we're hearing more voices, especially out of Africa, in relationship to this context and in relation to this conflict. Because if we don't really get that actual international voice, we can't really see where people are standing. And so it is really relevant and important to bring up this history that Russia has had with South Africa, and thinking about the recent comments made by President Ramaphosa. I mean, it really has so much to do, this long history of Russian support of the South African people and the struggle against apartheid. It really has a lingering resonance with people today and their perspective on really maintaining an independent position away from the U.S. and away from this kind of Western perspective. So I do really encourage people. I know on Breakthrough News, we've done a lot of coverage hearing voices from Africa, but I really encourage people to look out there. I mean, Mali, I mean, Sudan, there's a lot of really interesting perspective that you see. Eritrea, so many things out there, but I just, I could go on. I'm just such a fan of Gerald Horn.
I think we've talked a lot about the history so far, and we've talked a lot about it on this show, but I think it's really important. But I want to look at where we are now, because I feel like we're at this really, really crucial point over the last couple days, Rachel. And it's so important as the news gets worse, or seemingly worse, for us to look at, you know, with a clear head, really, what is happening. So on the one hand, we see Russia is backing out of places like Kiev and Chernihiv and other regions that are, you know, a little further into, a little further western in Ukraine. We're also seeing, though, on the other hand, an escalation of words from the U.S. and NATO. So right now, the U.K. is running the U.N. Security Council. They switch this off on a monthly basis. It happens to be the U.K. this month, and next month it happens to be the United States. Now, this is important because we have heard over the last few days in the media about these supposed atrocities that have happened in the city of Bucha. And, you know, hundreds of bodies have been found. This is an area that Russia did have forces in. And I think it's extremely important, because the coverage in the Western media is meant to pull at your heartstrings, to say, this bad thing happened, Russia's the bad guy, therefore they are fully responsible. Now, I'm not saying, and I don't think anyone can say, who is responsible for this right now. I'm not saying that Russia did or did not take part in some kind of action or war crime or whatever, right? What I am saying, though, Rachel, and I think this is so important for people to understand, is that we need to look at what Russia has been doing. And Russia called for a Security Council meeting to discuss and investigate what's happening and what happened in Bucha. But the UK, as this month's lead of the Security Council, blocked that. And instead today, they heard a speech from Zelensky. And so if the UN Security Council were actually interested in getting to the truth of having an investigation about Bucha and any other region where there were, you know, war crimes alleged to have occurred, they would have been entertaining this. There's also the reality that, like, the Pentagon the UN Security Council and NATO, all of them, are pushing the idea that they need more weapons and more money and more international support for Ukraine. I mean, yesterday at his press briefing, the Pentagon press secretary, John Kirby, and I think it's important that we not just watch the White House press, by the way, we should also be watching the press conferences at the Pentagon, because that's where some of the real interesting stuff comes out. Kirby announced that $2.3 billion in security assistance has been given in the Biden administration as a whole to Ukraine. $1.6 billion of that is since the Russian invasion started, so just over a month. I mean, $1.6 billion. He also, and I think this is extremely interesting, there's the U.S. 6th Fleet is going to be doing its regular Northern Viking exercises with NATO in Iceland, starting on April 14th. They should be canceling those. That is a provocation to do those kinds of exercises. To have any kind of military exercise anywhere near this conflict, to me, Rachel, I think that is absolutely, without a doubt, a provocation of Russia. In the meantime, they are continuing to send aid and weapons, and it continues on.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a provocation. I don't think you can look at it any other way. I mean, the U.S. always does this in an attempt to show force and show might and show power. And I really think that we have to be paying close attention to all these things that you're bringing up, Chris. And so you don't want to go anywhere. We have more for you if you stay tuned. But I want to remind you that you're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with more.
And you're listening to WBAI New York.
Welcome back. You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, brought to you by way of WBAI Radio in New York. Covert Action has been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. So, Rachel, this week we are marking the 54th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I think this is such an important thing to be talking about on this show overall, and also on this particular episode, as we are continuing to discuss the ways that the U.S. is pushing the world closer to World War III. We can never forget that King was in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was killed, supporting sanitation workers who were on strike, largely a population of black sanitation workers in the city, because literally it was some of the only jobs that, as black men, they could get. And they were on strike, and he was there to support. But this is also at a time that King was radicalizing, and he was speaking out more and more about the war in Vietnam. And in fact, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated, he gave an infamous speech at the Riverside Church in Harlem, which is a beautiful church, called, that's become known as Beyond Vietnam. And in it, he's talking about how he has seven major reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision, as he calls it. And I think that I want to play a short clip of one of the most important phrases from this speech, because then we can tie it back into what we've been discussing and also some questions that remain about his assassination.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our bonds, I cannot be silent.
What about Vietnam? That was the question that you could not ask, especially in the labor struggle, especially in the civil rights struggle. You could not ask the question, what about Vietnam? Because that would mean that these important struggles that were happening at the same time would come together, that they could see the unity between workers and students who were protesting the war, between black and white workers and students, would really threaten the actual power in the same way that the Vietnamese were threatening the power of the United States. And so when we look at the history of King, right, I mean, the FBI director, if you look at any of the files from COINTELPRO, like the FBI director, Herbert Hoover, like seemed to not just want to take out King politically, like he had a personal vendetta against King. I mean, if you read some of the files and the notes from COINTELPRO, like Hoover just clearly had it out for him. We know, for example, that the FBI sent a threatening letter to King, threatening to expose his affairs, and effectively the letter said, you should kill yourself, that's the only way out for you. This was all part of the FBI's COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program plan. Of course, they used this against the labor movement, they used it against the civil rights movement, and so many others, the anti-war movement. I mean, it was, you know, famously, you know, used against the Black Panther Party, to pit, you know, leaders and chapters against each other. But I think when we talk about King, there are a number two of questions about, you know, who is actually responsible for his death. There is the official government story, and, you know, Rachel, I want to hear what you're thinking, because there's an article from Jeremy Kuzmarov in Covert Action magazine outlining, you know, what the King family themselves have been saying, you know, about whether or not the official story that James Earl Ray shot MLK is actually the correct story.
Oh, yeah, no, the family's been saying for years they don't buy at all what the FBI has been saying. I mean, there's even been lawsuits. There's so much history when you could really look into it that just kind of shows that the family has been pushing back for quite some time and saying that they do not buy that narrative at all. And I mean, just to speak a little bit to those letters that you were speaking about as well, I think it's kind of crazy. And it's important to note that actually a draft letter was found in the FBI files years later on King. And the letter had a threat that was actually somewhat specific. It wasn't just like kill yourself. It was like, King, you are done, specifically. Like, that's wild to me. And they also wrote that the American public will know you for what you are, an evil, abnormal beast. Like, what? Like, this is outrageous. So it doesn't even take a genius to say, you know, okay, well, the FBI killed MLK. It's not even just about that. The FBI stalked, harassed, threatened, and did everything that they could to make King's life so profoundly difficult and so, like, impeded his work so much in all different ways that we know for a fact that there was an intent to intervene, an intent to stop the work of King. And so I do think that that is, to me, a very important element of this. And I also want to bring this kind of thought. This is the perspective I always have when you hear people talk about, oh, you know, the FBI killed Martin Luther King. A lot of people say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you know, but I do want to make this point about what a conspiracy theory really is. I mean, the idea of the term conspiracy is a term that actually didn't really start being used, or like calling it a conspiracy theory, that didn't start until after the assassination of JFK. And this was a way to delegitimize legitimize people that were bringing up very meaningful, valid concerns and meaningful, valid evidence that, that people were looking out to see. And calling something a conspiracy theory, which is a lot of what we see done in the conversation around King's assassination. You know, every conspiracy before it was proven at all was a theory. So like anything that is literally, the word conspiracy is a legal definition. That is what it is. A conspiracy to make on a different level, to talk together, to make decisions together, to conspire to do something, right? And I think it's important to bring that in here, because at the end of the day, so many things that have been proven to be true ultimately started off as this conspiracy theory. And so, you know, in some ways, to me, it's not as important about whether or not the FBI actually assassinated Martin Luther King. What's important in this story is understanding the depths and lengths through which the FBI will go to do anything possible to stop people's movements that are not only achieving traction in what they're fighting for, but people's movements that reach across and start to pull together issues that have a broader working class base. I mean, I really think, to me, that's the big takeaway. It's not so much, you know, whether or not we want to get into all the weeds, even though, you know, if you really want to get there, there's a lot of evidence, I will say.
Yeah, it is very convincing. And again, this article on covertactionmagazine.com by Jeremy Kuzmarov really does lay out a lot of the evidence. And I think people should read it and really understand why people question, you know, the official story here. And consider, I think, along the lines of what you were saying, Rachel, every time there is a big thing that comes out, right? I mean, I remember, I'm in technology, right? I remember you hear all the time, oh, the government's spying on us. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Well, then Snowden comes out, right? And it's like, whoops, it turns out we were right this whole time talking about the NSA spying on literally all of us. You know, so I think people should remember when you hear stuff like this, right? Consider, like, what else has the U.S. government done? And we know so much about what it has done. And that's why I'm so happy to be working with Covert Action, because they've really been responsible for so much of that history and saving it and exposing it. I think a lot about this stuff, following a lot of the things online that are said in various conspiracies and all of that. And, I mean, I guess I'll do a little bit of a hard pivot here talking about conspiracies. But tell us, Rachel, about these 457 minutes that are missing from the Trump phone logs on January 6, 2021.
Oh, Lord. I mean, so many things. I mean, recently, actually, this past Saturday, there was one of the prosecutors that worked on the whole Watergate scandal. Speaking of conspiracies, Watergate, so many things there. Literally a conspiracy, actually. Literally the legal terminology in thinking about that. But nonetheless, there was actually a Watergate prosecutor on Saturday that compared Donald Trump's missing January 6, 2020 phone logs to the missing logs in Richard Nixon's calls. And actually, for comparison, it's kind of wild to think that Nixon's gap in missing phone calls was actually like 18.5 minutes. Okay, 18.5 minutes about the Democratic National Convention compared to Trump having, you know, basically like seven hours of missing phone logs during the day of the Capitol riot. And the thing that we know for a fact on some level, I mean, there's no way you can look at this evidence and not immediately see what it is. You cannot imagine at all that during this time of crisis where we have January 6th happening, these right-wingers storming, you know, the Capitol, that there wasn't a single phone call to the White House, because there's nothing logged at all, meaning that basically, you know, every single phone call that comes into the White House gets logged no matter what, whether nobody picks it up, it gets logged. But there was nothing logged at all for that time that's missing. So I kind of think it's impossible to look at that and not conclude that all of this information was just deleted, which begs the bigger question about, you know, why was it deleted? And to me, the even bigger and most vital question at this moment, why can we have evidence like this so clearly in our face and we're still going through this long, drawn out, you know, is he going to get indicted for anything? Will we see anything? I mean, it wasn't until like literally last month that we even saw any mention whatsoever of potentially engaging, that Trump engaged in anything at all. I mean, last month, the congressional probe that's been investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection actually said that it had evidence that Donald Trump Trump and his campaign engaged in criminal conspiracy, quote unquote. It's the first time they even admitted that he could have done anything at all. How are we literally now an entire year plus out, and that's what's coming out this late with all this obvious evidence in our face? It's just, yeah, I mean, conspiracy all the way. There's a lot of things to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I love this quote from Jill Winebanks, who was involved in the Nixon investigation in 73, over, as you said, 18 and a half minutes of phone time. It says, where Jill Winebanks says, "It is often said that Nixon's cover-up was worse than his underlying crime. The reverse is potentially true for Trump." I mean, we're talking about a guy who's like, the worst punishment he's faced is that he lost his Twitter account. Like, really?
Yeah, I mean,
it's real, right? It is true. That's the truth. He lost his Twitter account. I mean, he was impeached, you know, and faced impeachment hearings twice. They were both shams. I thought, personally, both times, I did not support the impeachment proceedings. Not because I supported Donald Trump in any way. Absolutely not. But because that was the best the Democrats could offer, was to, like, impeach him.
Oh, it was.
You know, and I mean, yes, it was the best they could offer, right? But, like, really, that's the best anyone could do. I mean, it is very clear here, and I think the evidence has been there, that Trump, A, knew what was planned for that day, B, was part of the planning for that day, and C, really encouraged it. He had his phone on him because he was tweeting between 1 p.m. and 6:49 p.m., which is all in this time that from this gap that is being discussed, 11:17 a.m. to 6:54 p.m. on January 6th. He's tweeting, and at 2:24 p.m., he tweets about Mike Pence. He says, "Mike Pence doesn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts." Blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to read his whole tweet because I think the whole election was stolen idea is nonsense. But he knew exactly what was going on at the Capitol at that moment. He was very well aware, and we've already got the, you know, reports from people who were inside the White House at the time, including some people who left the job, who said, "I can't," you know, after January 6th. I mean, it's a little late to do it then, but, like, you got, like, 2 weeks left, you know, in your contract or whatever. But, like, they were like, "I can't do this. I'm leaving." But we know that he was watching, and that he was actually embarrassed only because he saw that the people who came were kind of poor. I mean, certainly poorer than him, right? But he knew exactly what was going on when he sent that tweet out. There are also records and interviews of calls with people like Senator Tommy Tuberville, trying to figure out, like, hey, what is going on here? But yeah, I mean, this quote, right, the reverse of the Nixon situation. I mean, the crime being worse than the cover-up. I fully agree with that analysis of this in this situation. Look, this was an attempted right-wing coup. I think there's no other way to look at it. There's no other way to analyze what happened on January 6th. And I think that people are forgetting that as we get further away from it.
Yeah. No, they totally are. And I get very frustrated with this because I think people, especially, you know, on the left, it's a very broad statement to make, but there are many people on the left. There's a lot of people that just kind of say, "Oh, you know, let's move past this. This is, you know, you're overblowing it. Don't think, you know, all the liberals are shrieking about it, so we shouldn't talk about it." No, like, at the end of the day, like, January 6th, we have to contextualize it for what it is. There has been this kind of push, I think, by the mainstream media, even the liberal media, to in some ways act as though, you know, January 6th was just kind of these individual crazies, like, oh, you know, this, the, you know, the, what is it, the QAnon shaman, like this, like, crazy dude with all the war paint on, like, okay, like, that's who this was all about. But actually, January 6th was part and parcel of a campaign that was led by leadership and donors of one of the major political representatives of the wealthy, including Trump himself, to actually overturn the results of the election based on completely obvious, clear, you know, demonstrable, obvious lies that were rooted in racism. You know, really, this is what, at the end of the day, to me, we have to think about January 6th was. It isn't just a bunch of crazies that came together and, you know, I guess somehow Donald Trump is involved in it. No, this is really serious how deep it goes and how far up the chain it goes. And I think in the conversation of January 6th, we can't ignore the kind of money that went into this and kind of the role of plutocrats and the role of the ultra wealthy really in making this happen. I think it was the billionaire who was a self-proclaimed conservative, Dick Olin, who actually gave the House Freedom Action, which is an organization that's the largest donor was actually the investment manager, Foster Freeze, who was also on the board of Turning Point USA, which organized the buses to January 6th, on and on and on and on. But nonetheless, you know, to get back to it, the House Freedom Action was given, you know, it was $1 million by Dick Olin. And he also donated $800,000 to Tea Party Patriots, which was one of the sponsors of January 6th in 2020, which brought his total contributions to the Tea Party Patriots to $4.3 million. And so we just have to follow the money in this situation and see that it is billionaires, it is the wealthy who were behind so much of January 6th and busing people there and getting people there and thinking about all the behind the scenes, the phone calls, everything being made was funded by these people. And on the other hand, too, there were people within the military structures and within the police structures locally for the Capitol as well that were all in on this thing. I mean, this is very disturbing. And I kind of want to bring this in here and just like put it out there because I think it kind of got lost a bit in the shuffle. There was an article in the Washington Post that was written last year, near the end of last year, by two retired U.S. Army major generals and a retired brigadier general who actually wrote that they are, quote, increasingly concerned about the aftermath of the 2024 presidential election. In the future 2024 presidential election and the potential for lethal chaos inside of our military, which would put all Americans at severe risk. They then said they were, quote, chilled to our bones at the thought of a coup succeeding next time. These people are top generals. They know what's going on. They knew it was, they know how the whole system operates. And for them to say that there's a potential for lethal chaos, I think speaks to what your point was, Chris, about this was a coup and we can't think about it any other way and we shouldn't undermine it.
Without a doubt. I mean, the letter in the Washington Post reminded me of the fact that shortly after January 6, 2021, actually the Joint Chiefs of Staff sent out a letter to like the entire military and the country. In fact, this is made a public letter, basically saying like the American people have trusted the armed forces to protect them for 250 years. This was a violent riot in Washington, D.C. It's an assault on Congress and the Constitution and the electoral process. Like the fact that they had to put that out, all eight Joint Chiefs signaled that they knew that there was something rotten going on, that like they knew that within the military itself, there were elements who were, you know, preparing for this, who were pushing for this. In fact, you know, 1 in 10, I believe, of the people who were arrested on January 6th had some kind of service background. We saw people who were dressed in like tactical gear, you know, in Congress, searching office to office. They had weapons, they had wrist ties, they had all sorts of things. I mean, who knows what would have happened if they had found Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi or AOC or, you know, any of those that they were chanting about. So again, I mean, we are over a year out from January 6th. I think the investigation is going to go on. It is taking entirely too long. And I think we agree on that, certainly. But we will be keeping an eye on it here at Covert Action Bulletin, because we know that some interesting stuff is going to come out of this.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it is frustrating that we're this far out and the U.S. Attorney General, who this is like they made all these promises that everyone who committed crimes related to January 6th would be held accountable. And it's almost 2024 and I don't see any accountability for Trump. But either way, you know, I kind of want to there's a lot here to really get into, but I really want to get into our next story, which I feel really strongly about. I mean, I don't know if people saw this, but if you didn't, just like shout out. Let's get excited. I mean, you know, Amazon workers in Staten Island, they actually unionized. They unionized the first ever warehouse for Amazon in the entire country. And so that's something that I'm just still blown away by. Like after all of the repression, after everything, they were able to unionize. And I think that, you know, among so many kind of depressing elements of what we look around and see in terms of the capitalist media and just what's going on under this system, to see workers really win in the face of so much repression in so many different ways, it really really inspires me on all different levels. And I want to name too, like, these workers are unionizing in some of the most insane conditions. Like, you know, actually, I read this study recently that said an estimated 60% of large employers use workplace monitoring tools, some of which can be used to chill organizing, particularly to like target organizing and organizers. Like, I read a story about these hotel worker union, this hotel worker union in Southern California that actually reported that management crashed one of their Zoom calls that was all the workers with the organizers, with the union reps and everything. And that one of the workers actually said that workers started to get super nervous. They all shut down their cameras because they didn't want to get seen. And one of the workers who had been volunteering to do something on the call actually got harassed out of his job. He was pressured to quit the very next day. And so this is like pretty, you know, standard when we think about what do these companies do, you know, thinking about the repression that these companies put on workers. I mean, also thinking too about Walmart's methods and Amazon Whole Foods in particular methods. They use heat maps, which is kind of like crazy the way they use technology. They use heat maps that were based on predictive analytics to track store locations considered at high risk for union activity. And actually, Google reportedly has this system that alerts managers at Google to any internal meetings scheduled with 100 or more employees. And so they're using these heat mappings to see who's meeting, how many people are meeting together. And this is really, you know, it's really crazy, actually, because, you know, it's really just to weed out employee organizing. Like, all of these tools of technology can be used. And so for to see these workers in the face of, you know, what a lot of people feel is this pressing technology crush, that's like, how do we ever overcome? To see them overcome, I think, really speaks to the power of organizing and to really never give up. Because at the end of the day, sure, they have billions of dollars and they have all this technology, but ultimately we have the workers, and that's what matters, you know?
I mean, yeah, we have the workers. Look, we're recording this on Tuesday, April 5th. This morning, Christian Smalls, who is one of the lead organizers of this campaign in Staten Island, tweeted out, since we won, Amazon Labor has been contacted by workers in over 50 buildings nationwide, not including the several buildings overseas and counting. And that's just so exciting. That could be tens of thousands, potentially 100,000 workers or more at Amazon. And this is, of course, is following on the heels of Starbucks stores unionizing and Howard Schultz being brought back in as CEO, saying that unions are a threat to democracy and freedom. So on this question of like these tools, right, like the workers on the Zoom meetings and all of that, I mean, I have to say, like, if you are trying to organize a union, 100% do it. Definitely be in touch with other organizers and do it off of your work devices. If you do it off of your work Wi-Fi network, like, don't be like on your Wi-Fi talking on Messenger or whatever. You know, that companies will spend, and we've seen this over and over, companies will spend millions and millions of dollars to prevent a union from even forming or from people sharing the idea of the union before they spend $1 million to address the grievances of workers. So if you don't talk on your work phone, your work, you know, email, your work, anything about work, unless it's your job, don't complain about your job. Don't complain about your boss. None of that, because I can guarantee you if they want to see it, they will. And there is a good amount of security that you have to take into consideration when undertaking such an enormous task. And so, again, congratulations, though, to these workers in Staten Island. And let's not forget, there's a second contested election happening in Bessemer, Alabama right now. We thought we were going to have the results already. There has been more trickery by Amazon, just like the first time. And maybe on another episode, we can get into some of the ways that historically companies have messed with union organizers and elections. But suffice it to say for right now, I believe that what we're looking at here is going to lead to, you know, more surveillance by these companies. But ultimately, as you said, there are more workers than there are bosses. And the workers are the ones that if we don't show up for work, then nothing happens. Packages don't get out. Those vans don't get driven. all of it stops.
We do. It's actually funny that organizer Chris Smalls was like thanking Jeff Bezos for going to space so they could organize a union while this man is in space. I just thought that was hilarious. But I fully agree with you, Chris. And I want to throw it out here. Like, this is the company that works workers literally like to almost dying conditions. Some of them have died, obviously, with the pandemic. But this is actually in 2011, which was a long time ago, actually, now. You know, in Allentown, Pennsylvania, Amazon was actually hiring paramedics and ambulances during summer heat waves because so many workers were literally being removed on stretchers and being brought out. It's like they have money to I guess, hire paramedics so their workers can die, but they really can't take the profit hit at all of slowing down. So I just wanted to throw that in there just as a piece of information to just get how historic this is. And you're so right. The floodgates are open and there really is no going back. But either way, we are going to have to leave it right there. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin with Rachel Hu.
And Chris Garaffa.
Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine, brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you like what you heard, subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you can find podcasts. You can go ahead and search for Covert Action Bulletin, or you can also listen on your station's archives. We're all out of time. Thanks for listening.
Covert Action.
This is Ralph Pointer. Join me and others every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. It would appear the human movement is such that at any moment in history, there are too few that understand possibilities of existence that would benefit all who inhabit this planet and are willing to act on this understanding. This program will feature that few. What are your views on these issues that impact your life today? What are your views on America today? What are your views on America's future? Can we talk? Call in 212-209-2877. Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.
This is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties, end your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hi there. For WBAI New York, I'm Linda Perry. As we move through April, I want to take a moment to thank new WBAI buddies, new BAI buddies who joined WBAI during Women's History Month. Jane Gennaro from the Upper West Side says, thanks for the beautiful programming for Women's History Month. Lucia Calamnaro is also a new buddy. She's from Boston, Massachusetts. She says, I can't choose a favorite program. You're a treasure, WBAI. So grateful you are here. Thank you also to Michelle Babian from Yonkers, a new buddy whose message is peace with the earth. Victoria from Terrytowns appreciates all WBAI shows. Jean-Louis from Long Island loves Gary Null's show. Steve Stansel from Brooklyn, New York is now a buddy at $20 a month. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Sandra Lynn, who appreciates WBAI's new morning show, What's Going On? She's a new buddy, and so is Francois from Brooklyn. Also from Brooklyn, Ben Yee is a new BAI buddy. His favorite show is from Margaret Flowers, Clearing the Fog. Ellis Landy from the Bronx says she loves WBAI. She's a new WBAI buddy, and so is Sandra from Ringwood, New Jersey. Her favorite show is Code Pink Radio. Ken from Harlem is also a new WBAI buddy. He's contributing $50 a month. He's from Harlem. His favorite show is Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Gloria J. Brown Marshall with Law of the Land, and other shows. He says there's so many he loves. Lloyd from Brooklyn is a new WBAI buddy. Thank you so much, Lloyd. Amma from Flushing is also a new buddy. Thank you. So is Thomasina in New Jersey, and Betty Garland, who likes Vantage Point and Mansion for a Rat. Thank you. Pedro Chinnery from Suffern, New York, is also a new WBAI buddy, showing the reach of WBAI. He appreciates equal rights and justice. Laurie from the Upper West Side likes building bridges. Mike from Brooklyn is a new buddy in the name of Con Sabor Latino. Brenda from Montclair, New Jersey, appreciates any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Thanks also to John from Chicago, a $100 buddy. Thank you so much to all of our new WBAI buddies, our monthly contributors, large and small and small and large. We so appreciate you and your continued support. If you'd like to become a WBAI buddy, just go to our website, WBAI.org, and click Buddy, or call 212-209-2950. And remember to tell us what your favorite show is. I don't have time to list all the new buddies right here and right now, but know that we thank you. Thank you so very much for your support.